And hello, SunSounds listeners. This is Andy Bombeck, which means, once again, it's time for the Children's Story Hour. And as always, I'm glad you could join me today for a good variety of children's stories. Like always, the first half hour, I'll be reading picture books. And then the second half hour, I'm going to continue with a novel that I've been reading now for about 5.5 months, titled The Ballad of Darcy and Russell. But first, let's begin today's program with the picture book titles. I'm going to start off with a book titled The Monkey and the Crocodile. Then it's Arno and His Horse. Janie Writes a Play. Jane Yolen's First Great Story. Twinkle's Fairy Pet Day. This Is Not That Kind of Book. And if we have time, I'll finish up the first half hour with Nor and Bobby. So it should be a lot of fun. Let's get started with our first picture book today, titled The Monkey and the Crocodile. Beside a river in the jungle stood a tall mango tree. In the tree lived many monkeys. They swung from branch to branch, eating fruit and chattering to each other. Hungry crocodiles swam in the river and sunned themselves on the banks. One young crocodile was hungrier than all the rest. He could never get enough to eat. The young crocodile watched the monkeys for a long time. Then one day he said to a wise old crocodile, "I'd like to catch a monkey and eat him." "How would you ever catch a monkey?" asked the old crocodile. "You do not travel on land, and monkeys do not go into the water. Besides, they are quicker than you are." "Oh, they may be quicker," said the young crocodile, "but I am more cunning. You will see." For days, the crocodile swam back and forth, studying the monkeys all the while. Then he noticed one young monkey who was quicker than all the others. This monkey loved to jump to the highest branches of the tree and pick the ripe mangoes at the very top. "He's the one I want," the crocodile said to himself. "But how am I going to catch him?" The crocodile thought and thought, and at last he had an idea. "Monkey," he called, "wouldn't you like to come with me over to the island where the fruit is so ripe?" "Oh, yes," said the monkey. "But how can I go with you? I do not swim." "I will take you on my back," said the crocodile with a toothy smile. The monkey was eager to get to the fruit, so he jumped down on the crocodile's back. "Off we go," said the crocodile, gliding through the water. "Wow, this is a fine ride you are giving me," said the monkey. "Do you think so? Well, how do you like this?" asked the crocodile, and suddenly he dived down into the water. "Oh, please don't," cried the monkey as he went under. He was afraid to let go, and he did not know what to do. When the crocodile came up, the monkey sputtered and choked. "Why did you take me under the water, crocodile?" he asked. "You know I can't swim." "Because I am going to drown you," replied the crocodile, "and then I am going to eat you." The monkey shivered with fear, but he thought quickly, and before the crocodile dived again, he said, "I wish you had told me you wanted to eat me. If I had known that, I would have brought my heart." "Your heart?" asked the crocodile. "Yes, it is the tastiest part of me, but I left it behind in the tree." "Well, then we must go back and get it," said the crocodile, turning around. "But we are so near the island," said the monkey. "Please, take me there first." "No," said the crocodile. "First, I am taking you straight to your tree. You will get your heart and bring it to me at once. Then we will see about going to the island." "Very well," said the monkey. and the crocodile headed back to the riverbank. No sooner did the monkey jump onto the bank than up he swung into the tree. From the highest branch, he called down to the crocodile, "My heart is way up here. If you want it, come for it. Come for it." And he laughed and laughed while the crocodile thrashed his tail in anger. That night, the monkey moved far down the river from the mango tree. He wanted to get away from the crocodile so he could live in peace. But the crocodile was still determined to catch him. He searched and searched, and finally he found the monkey, living in another tree. Here, a large rock rose out of the water, halfway between the monkey's new home and the island. The crocodile watched the monkey jumping from the riverbank to the rock, and then to the island where the fruit trees were. "Monkey, will you stay on the island all day?" the crocodile thought to himself, "and I'll catch him on his way home tonight." The monkey had a fine feast while the crocodile swam about, watching him all day. Toward night, the crocodile crawled out of the water and lay on the rock perfectly still. When it grew dark among the trees, the monkey started for home. He ran down to the riverbank, and there he stopped. "What is the matter with the rock?" the monkey wondered. "I never saw it so high before. Something must be lying on it." The monkey went to the water's edge and called, "Hello, rock!" No answer. He called again, "Hello, rock!" Still no answer. 3 times the monkey called, and then he said, "Why is it, my friend, that you do not answer me tonight?" "Oh," said the crocodile to himself, "the rock must talk to the monkey at night. I'll have the answer for the rock this time." So he answered, "Yes, monkey, what is it?" The monkey laughed and said, "Oh, it's you, crocodile. Is it?" "Yes," said the crocodile. "I am waiting here for you, and I'm going to eat you up." "You have certainly caught me this time," said the monkey, sounding afraid. "There is no other way for me to go home. Open your mouth wide so I can jump right into it." Now the monkey knew very well that when crocodiles open their mouths wide, they shut their eyes. So, while the crocodile lay on the rock with his mouth open and his eyes shut, the monkey jumped, but not into his mouth. He landed on top of the crocodile's head and then sprang quickly to the riverbank. Up he ran into his tree. When the crocodile saw the trick the monkey had played on him, he said, "Monkey, I thought I was cunning, but you are much more cunning than I, and you know no fear. I will leave you alone after this." "Thank you, crocodile," said the monkey, "but I shall be on the watch for you just the same." And so he was, and the crocodile never caught him. Arno and his horse. Arno had a horse. It's a toy horse. It was brown and it was black. He took it with him everywhere, but did he bring it back? Back along the riverbed, we shifted through the sand. Then we searched for Arno's little horse all across the land. "Are you sure you left it here?" asked Mercy with a frown. "I can't remember," Arno whispered, "where I put it down." We looked in our house with the fort and the swings. We didn't find the horse, but we found some other things. Back to the playground, we climbed up the tree. We looked over the county as far as we could see. Back to the bush, we ran from here to there. Mercy said, "Your little horse, it could be anywhere." Back to the store with apples and the corn. We found a lot of stuff to buy. The horse, it was still gone. Back to the field where we'd played with some boys. We looked in the shed and we tipped out all the toys. The last thing we found was a ball that was flat. "Okay," said Dad, "we're done with that." "Can't you play with something else? The Frisbee, your toy train?" But this was Arno's favorite thing. He couldn't quite explain the feel of it upon his hand and all the different ways the little horse reminded him of other far-off days. And of things his grandpa told him about the old times long ago. Rode his horse across the river when the river was in flow. Grandpa made the toy for him. He'd carved it out of wood. "We need to find it," Arno said. "I really think we should." It had big eyes, a peaceful face, made Arno's mind feel light. He thought of his horse every day. He dreamt of it at night. Arno asked his grandpa, he asked him in his dreams, "Can you see it, Grandpa? Can you bring it back to me?" And do you know what little horse was deep, deep down below? And in the night, it started up with quite a way to go. Down along the river now, past tall trees under stars, the little horse, it journeyed on around the sleeping cars. In bed, Arno was dreaming of holding Grandpa's hand, walking down the riverbed, drawing in the sand. And in the dream, he somehow saw the horse from long ago, his grandpa riding bareback when the river was in flow. His grandpa rode from bank to bank, brave and strong and free. He wasn't frail or sick or sad, but how he used to be. Arno raced out in the night, the stars gone from the river. But in their place, the night shone bright, and he could see forever. He knew now where his horse would be, just near the longest bridge. He ran along the gravel road until he reached the ridge. And there it was, his special horse. It was a little battered, but as he'd hoped, the horse came back. And that was all that mattered. Janey writes a play, Jane Yolen's first great story. And this book is dedicated for Janey, who grew up to be my mom. She continues to inspire me and countless other writers to tell their great stories. And for Yolanda, who let me share Janey's story with the world. And to my sister Katie, who has supported and encouraged me since the day we were born, spending countless hours reading and creating our own stories that still inspire me. And to Jane and Heidi, whose books fueled a love for reading that grew into a lifelong passion for creating picture books. It is an honor to be part of this one. The night before play rehearsals began, Janey couldn't sleep. She imagined grand sets and soaring music, exciting dances and catchy songs, and most importantly, a great story. Janey loved a great story. Janey grabbed a book from beside her bed. It was much too old for her and there were many words she didn't quite understand. But she loved the way the words sounded, even if she didn't know what they meant yet. She wrote them in her notebook to look up later. In the morning, Janie jumped out of bed. She looked out her window across the street to the park. Anyone else would have seen rocks and trees and people picnicking and taking walks. But Janie imagined pirates with cutlasses drawn in fierce battle on the deck of an ancient galleon. A boy writing a message to the moon on his kite, and a little girl who stomped her huge feet in a dinosaur-sized tantrum. Before Janie ran out the door, she jotted those story ideas in her notebook. In the elevator, she told Mr. Swartz about the play. Then she handed him the latest copy of the newspaper she and her little brother, Stevie, had written, filled with all the news from their building. "That'll be 5 cents," Stevie said, as Mr. Swartz opened his wallet. Janie waved hello to the butcher, sweeping his front steps as she walked the 5 blocks to her school, P.S. number 93. "Today's the big day, Janie," the butcher called out. Janie nodded. She twirled in anticipation of a great story filled with drama and plot twist. She waited patiently through math and science and English until finally it was time to begin the first play rehearsal. But when she read the script, Janie felt deflated. "Aren't you excited?" asked Mrs. Giller. "You're girl number one. You got the lead role." Janie wasn't excited. There was no rising plot or big moment. There was no satisfying ending. There wasn't any singing or dancing. It wasn't a great story. It wasn't even a good story. The play was going to be a boring bust. At the bar in ballet class, Janie's fondus didn't rise. Across the floor, her jetties didn't lift. At the end of class, all the dancers joined in the center of the room and danced together. Everyone together. It made a satisfying ending. A story began to form in Janie's head. After class, she wrote it in her notebook. During dinner, Janie poked at her vegetables. She lined up her carrots and peas in different formations. When her dad asked what she was doing, she answered distractedly, "Choreography." Stevie yelled, "Choreograph peas?" Everyone laughed. After dinner, Janie grabbed her notebook and began to take notes. Dance class, vegetables, and a new play. She stayed up late into the night, writing lines, creating characters, and setting scenes. She crossed out some words and then wrote some more. "We are the kids of the vegetable group. When we're together, we're all in a troop." In the morning, she wasn't tired. She was exhilarated. In the elevator, Janie was too busy humming a new song from her notebook. So Stevie interviewed Mrs. Swartz for the newspaper. Janie danced all the way to P.S. 93. Mrs. Giller was confused when Janie handed her the new script, but she appreciated and supported her students' work, so she gathered the class together and handed out new roles. "Alan and Marcel, you are tomatoes," said Mrs. Giller. "Susan H. and Susan L., you are stalks of celery. Barbara, Brianna, Diane, and Dolores, you are lettuce." Janie was the chief carrot. They rehearsed all week. When the curtains rose on the night of the play, The audience was respectfully quiet. They clapped at the beginning of every new scene. They cheered at the end of every musical number. When Janie belted out the finale, the audience rose to their feet in a standing ovation. It was a great story. Brava, bravo, author, author. It was Janie's first rave review. It wouldn't be her last. Janie never stopped loving a great story, and she never, ever stopped writing. Now, that's a satisfying ending. And here's the author's note. Little Janie grew up to be Jane Yolen, the famous award-winning author of more than 400 books. As a child, she lived in New York City in an apartment that had 14 windows overlooking Central Park. Her parents let her read books that she didn't understand yet, some of which are still her favorites today. She and her brother Steve, who became a journalist, wrote a newspaper, which their mom typed up one copy at a time. Jane and Steve sold copies to their neighbors for 5 cents. Jane attended PS 93 public school, and all the students in the story are real. So is Jane's favorite teacher, Mrs. Giller. Mrs. Giller always knew that Jane would become a writer. She contacted Jane years later to tell her how proud she was. Jane can't remember the name of the butcher, but she passed his shop each day on her way to school. The play with the vegetables really did happen. Jane's story and performance as the chief carrot were a smashing success. She still talks about it 75 years later. Twinkle's Fairy Pet Day. Twinkle wanted a pet more than anything, and so did her best friends, Pippa and Lulu. Twinkle even made up a special song. I've waited and wished for such a long time for a sweet little pet who will truly be mine. When Fairy Godmother heard Twinkle's song, she invited all three fairies to the palace. You're now old enough to take care of a pet, she said, so let's make your wishes come true. Pippa, what's your pet spell? Abracadabra, skiddly pie, my pet loves to swoop and fly. Pippa waved her wand gracefully, and in a sparkly flash, a gorgeous butterfly appeared. Fairy-tastic! I love butterflies, said Pippa. Then it was Lulu's turn. Abracadabra, skiddledy-pop. My pet loves to jump and hop. A glittery ladybug landed on Lulu's head. Oh, lovely, said Lulu. Twinkle couldn't wait for her sweet little pet to arrive. She swooshed her wand wildly around her head, and then she said her spell. Abracadabra, skiddledy-day. My pet loves to run and play. Bang! Crash! Boom! The walls shook. The chandelier swayed. Purple smoke poured out of the fireplace, and then out popped a little dragon. Fiddlesticks and fairy cakes, exclaimed Twinkle. I really wanted something cute and fluffy, not a dragon. Oh, he just needs a little bit of training, that's all, said Fairy Godmother, avoiding the puffs of smoke. Now, why don't you all bring your pets to Fairy Pet Day? There'll be prizes and fun for everyone. But Scruffy needed more than just a bit of training. He gobbled up Twinkle's fairy cakes, left muddy footprints everywhere, and even chewed her best slippers. Twinkle decided it was time for dragon training. "Please fetch the ball now, Scruffy," said Twinkle, as Scruffy happily galloped past her. "Okay, try jumping this fence," said Twinkle. But the little dragon was snoring under a tree. "Please be a good little dragon and sit now, Scruffy," said Twinkle. But Scruffy just wagged his tail and ran around in circles. "Oh dear," said Twinkle, tickling Scruffy's tummy. "I'll never be able to train you in time." When Fairy Pet Day at the palace arrived, Twinkle scrubbed and brushed Scruffy until his scales were shining. She tied a pretty ribbon in his top knot and gave him a fancy new collar. "You'll surely win a prize for being cute, even if you are the naughtiest dragon in the forest," Twinkle said. But on the way to the palace, Scruffy jumped in a great big puddle and splashed mud everywhere. "Oh no," sighed Twinkle. "We'll never win anything now." Fairy Pet Day. The palace was crowded with fairies and their pets. Everyone applauded as Pippa's butterfly won a prize for prettiest pet, and Lulu's ladybug won a prize for her clever tricks. It was soon time for the Best Trained Pet Award. Twinkle knew Scruffy didn't have a chance, but she loved her new pet anyway. "Just do your best, Scruffy," she whispered. Scruffy cocked his ears and gazed sweetly at Twinkle as she tossed a ball high into the sky. "Go, Scruffy," Twinkle shouted. Scruffy zoomed off like a rocket, did a few loop-de-loops, and disappeared. But then the little dragon raced back through the clouds and dropped the ball at Twinkle's feet. "Hooray!" everyone cheered. "Congratulations," said Fairy Godmother as she gave Twinkle and Scruffy their prize. "What a well-trained little dragon!" Twinkle was so proud her wings glowed rainbow colors, and she sang happily to Scruffy. "Scruffy is my dragon, and he loves to run and play. He's the best pal ever, and I love him more each day." And I'm going to finish up the first half hour of today's program with a picture book titled, "This Is Not That Kind of Book." Hey, this is not an alphabet book, and there's a letter A. "Sorry, this is a fairy tale. Come see." Once upon a time, a brave little girl set off into the woods with a basket of goodies. "I'm an apple. Hop in." But the forest soon darkened around her. Something was lurking in the shadows. "Hungry animal? Oh, it's going to be a wolf. I'm very familiar with this type of story." And it's a girl, little girl, dressed in a red, like Little Red Riding Hood. Just then, a robot burst from the trees. "Stop! Ah! Aren't you supposed to be a wolf?" "This is not that kind of book." The girl thought it was unusual to find a robot in the forest. "But it's not so unusual when you're in..." "What kind of book is this? Come see." "The Gleep Gork Forest of Mars," which is exactly where they went. And they were not alone. A strange creature was headed their way. "Does that say Mars? Fairy tales don't happen on Mars. I told you this was not that kind of book." "But why am I in this book?" "You have a cape. You must be a superhero." The robot, the apple, the A, and the girl, who may have been a superhero, ran as fast as they could. "I don't feel like a superhero, and before the creatures could reach them, they ducked inside a cozy little schoolhouse.
Robots are not usually in schools like this.
Hey, what are you doing here? This is not your kind of book. It was Hedgeable T. Hedgehog's first day of kindergarten, and she couldn't wait to meet her new classmates. She was certain they would all become the closest of friends.
So, what kind of book is this?
Well, the kind where all the characters are animals, but we dress in people's clothes, and we go to school, and we learn lessons about friendship. So, you don't belong here.
The book says you're waiting for your classmates. Maybe that's us.
Nope, this is not that kind of book.
Hedgeable was certain her new classmates would be other animals in people's clothes, not robots or letters or people in people clothes.
I'm an apple.
Hide on the desk. Maybe she won't notice.
Knock, knock. Shoo, my real friends are finally here. I think somebody needs those friendship lessons right away.
Knock, knock.
Coming.
Real friends coming.
Careful, a strange creature is out there.
Don't open that door.
Alarm, alarm.
But Hedgeable T. Hedgehog was not the kind of hedgehog who took advice from robots or letters or people in people clothes.
Knock, knock.
Who's there? Pie.
Huh? You're not my new classmates.
You're supposed to say pie who?
This is not that kind of book.
Not a joke book, but I'm a banana named Captain Knock Knock. What other kind of book could I be in?
The strange creature was not scary. The strange creature was just confused. In fact, everyone was confused.
Maybe this is an ABC book after all, and you are the B thing.
Or the C thing, C for captain.
Maybe you're a superhero like her.
I don't think I'm a superhero.
There are other kinds of captains like pirates.
Hey, that's my joke. Knock, knock.
Who's there?
Pie, pie who?
Pirates are coming. Pirates are coming.
Arr, that'll be high Arlarius.
Where did he come from?
No, 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 no. This is not that kind of book.
Ah, 'tisn't a bone-chilling tale of the stormy seas.
Do they have bananas at seas?
No one seemed to know exactly what kind of book this was, or who belonged in it. But perhaps, if they worked together, they could solve the mystery.
Did somebody say mystery?
Enough. Get out, all of you. This is an Animals at School book. There are no pirates, no bananas, no robots, no superheroes, no talking letters, and no detectives. None of you belong here.
I'm an apple.
Hedgehog Hedgeable waited alone in the classroom for the arrival of her real friends. She waited a long time.
Guys?
She began to wonder if maybe she had made a mistake. Guys? She began to wonder if maybe this was not that kind of book.
Hey, guys, I think I made a mistake.
So, where are your new friends?
I think maybe this is, not that kind of book.
That's what the words say.
This was not that kind of book.
Arr, what kind of book is it, then? We need to know.
Who belongs here and who doesn't?
Anybody?
I'm an apple.
But there was only one way to find out what kind of book this was. But it would require bravery. There would be no backing out.
Back out? That's it. I'm going to the back cover.
Outside the book?
Dar could be danger.
Wait, wait, I'll go with you.
No one should be alone.
The others waited.
I hope they're okay.
Well, I'm too nervous for jokes. And waited.
They've been gone a long time. Our pirates are not good at waiting.
Finally, the explorers returned.
They made it.
What did you find? What kind of book is this?
This is a book about a group of characters who have nothing in common, but who work together to figure out what kind of book they're in.
Ta-da!
Well, I've never heard of that kind of a book. Then again, I am a banana.
Is that even a real kind of book?
I don't have a clue.
It was a real kind of book. It was their book.
Don't you realize what this means? We're all supposed to be here. Anybody can belong in a book like this.
Anybody?
The mystery was solved, and Hedgeable T. Hedgehog had something very important to add.
I owe you all an apology. I never should have kicked you out of my classroom. In fact, all of you are my new fur.
Hey, wait, I learned a lesson about friendship. This is that kind of book.
I was right,
actually, but so were the rest of you. And they lived happily ever after, the end.
So, what if it says the end?
Let's have a picnic. I left a basket of goodies in the forest at the beginning of the book.
Wow, the scary Martian forest? Don't worry, you're with friends.
Amigos, I'm excited to see what happens next. I'm an apple.
And this is just a reminder. My name is Andy Bombeck, and I hope you're enjoying the Children's Story Hour. And as I mentioned at the beginning of today's program, for the second half hour, I'm going to continue with the novel that I've been reading now for about 5.5 months, titled The Ballad of Darcy and Russell. Darcy believes in love at first sight. She's spent her whole life waiting for that perfect magical moment. But right now, her life is anything but perfect. After a music festival, she's stranded at a bus station until morning, the day before she leaves for college. Her phone is dead, she has no cash, and she's convinced nothing good can come of this night. But then she meets Russell. Russell, cute and nice, funny and kind. This is the moment and the guy she's been waiting for. And they have until sunrise to walk and talk and connect. Over the course of this one fateful night, filled with football field picnics, night swimming, and escape artist dogs, Darcy and Russell's lives will change forever. They'll discover things they never imagined about each other and about themselves. But can you really know someone after only a handful of hours? Is it possible to fall in love in just one day? And is it worth saying hello when you know you're destined for a goodbye? Okay, last week, while looking for the dog Andy, Russell really opened up to Darcy why he lied to her when they first met. He is now explaining to Darcy why he and his dad got into a fight at the festival. And remember, his dad is the lead singer of the band playing at the festival. Michigan's still a really good school, though. Even if you didn't get into the musical theater part of it. Yeah, Russell said, but not very convincingly. He trailed off, but I somehow knew that he was working through something. Not to jump in just yet, but to let him get there.
Well, it's what my dad and I fought about, he finally said, at Silverspun. It's how I ended up in the bus station to begin with.
You fought about Michigan?
Yeah, when I first applied, I didn't get into the BFA program. But I got waitlisted for the regular admission. And then, in May, I got a letter telling me I was off the wait list for the regular school. And it seemed like what I should do. Like you said, it's a good school. Everyone was happy. My mom got to tell all of her friends where I was going. It made sense, right? I nodded, recognizing something in his expression, the look of desperately trying to turn lemons into lemonade. So that was the plan. But then, right before my dad was taking the stage at Silverspun, I was backstage with him. He'd given me his phone to hold while he warmed up. And that's when I saw the email. He paused and took a breath before he went on, the way you do before you jump into cold water, bracing yourself for what's coming. It was for Michigan. They were giving him an update on their plans for the generous donation he'd pledged back in May. Oh, and it made me feel so stupid. I think that was the worst part, you know? I was so embarrassed that I'd let myself be proud I'd gotten in. Because, of course, I hadn't done it on my own. Of course, my dad pulled strings to make it happen. Of course, they didn't want me, not without him. Wow, that's a lot. All at once, I understood why Russell, I'd met shortly after this, had all gone down, wouldn't have wanted to tell me who he really was. Why being Wiley Sanders' son in that moment would be the last thing he'd want to claim. Well, as soon as the show was over, I confronted him about it. Russell's voice was raw, like he was still processing this. Present tense. And the worst part was that he didn't seem to understand why I was upset. And then he was hurt because he had done what he thought was a good thing, and I was throwing it in his face. Russell stumbled over a loose piece of gravel. I reached out to him instinctively, but he righted himself and kicked the rock away angrily. Anyway, then I told him I didn't ask for this, and I didn't want anything of his, and I didn't need him. Well, that was me being very mature, by the way. I laughed at that, and Russell shook his head. And then I ran out and found the buses that were going to L.A., and I got on the first one. And then what happened? Russell stared at me for a second, then laughed. Yeah, good one. I walked next to him in silence for a moment as I thought through all of this. I suddenly flashed to the way his face had crumpled back in the Silver Standard office when he'd finally pulled out his phone. I realized now what I hadn't known then, just how much it had cost him to make that call. So did you guys, I don't know, clear the air? Well, I think we're basically called a timeout. My dad and I don't fight much. It's like we don't have the skill set or something. So we weren't getting anywhere, just going around in circles. I nodded and we walked in silence for a moment, but the kind of silence that felt like an ellipse, not a period. I just think the fundamental problem is that he doesn't understand why I'm upset. He just thinks I'm being ungrateful. And I know this is a ridiculous thing to be complaining about. I'm crazy lucky and so privileged. And I know that. I do. But his voice trailed off. Yeah, I said slowly. I knew full well that I could just leave this here. I didn't have to talk about me or my situation, even though they were actually kind of similar. But all at once, I wanted to. I took a big breath and made myself say it. I kind of know what that's like, to feel like it wasn't your choice. It sucks. Well, it really does, Russell said, even though I could hear the question in his voice. So, is your dad also a huge rock star? Oh, man. Did I forget to mention that? So embarrassing. My name is actually Darcy Matthews Band, Russell laughed. You know Band isn't actually part of Dave's last name, right?
Well, you call him Dave? The second I ask it, I shook my head. I mean, of course you do. Russell cleared his throat.
Well, he is my godfather.
Seriously?
Yep.
Well, it was the first one I thought of. I couldn't remember Bono's real last name.
Hewson. Okay. Is he also your godfather?
Nope. He's Connor's.
I smiled, shaking my head, and looked over at Russell.
He was looking back at me steadily, like he knew I was stalling. I took a breath and twisted my fingers in the dog's fur. It was just, I kind of understand, that is, my voice was coming out haltering and jerky like a car. I couldn't quite get to start.
What you were saying about Michigan, I finally said.
Right. I'm kind of in a similar thing with Stanwich.
Because you got that great financial aid package?
I nodded, and once again, it was like I could see my escape hatch.
I could just leave this there, but I was done keeping it close to my chest. The thing that had been wrecking my sleep and churning my thoughts for months now, I wanted to share it with the one person who, I realized, might actually understand. It's actually because of my mother.
Your mother?
Yeah, I took a breath and told him the truth. She works in the HR department at Stanwyck College. Russell frowned.
But I thought, you said, she was in England.
Well, she was, but she moved back to the States last year. I started walking a little faster, and Russell sped up to keep pace with me.
So that was a fact about your life that you forgot to mention?
Russell, sorry.
We walked in silence for a moment, and I could feel Russell looking over at me, waiting for me to continue, as I tried to figure out what exactly I wanted to say.
So your mom works at the college? And that's how you have such a great aid package, right?
He was laying out the facts, but I could also hear the question in his voice. He was struggling to understand why this was such a big deal.
I suddenly flashed back to the Stanwyck College brochure Gillum had sent to me. The post-it with her handwriting on the front. A perfect place for a fresh start.
As though it was that easy. As though it was a thing she got to decide.
It's just, my mom left when I was 2.
Oh, I watched his face change, like he was shifting gears.
You said your parents got divorced.
They did, eventually, after she walked out.
She wanted to be an actress. And I guess we were holding her back?
I tried to toss this off the way I always did when I talked about Jillian. But it wasn't working this time. The words were settling on me, heavy with their meaning. I mean, who knows? She and my dad had me pretty young. I don't think I was part of either of their plans. I glanced over at Russell in the moonlight, his expression letting me know that it was okay, that I could go on.
It's just, this was something I tried not to think about too much, but that would inevitably creep in, an insidious whisper whenever I was feeling particularly low. It was probably me who wrecked their plans, actually. My dad trying to be a novelist, Jillian, my mother, trying to be an actress. But then I came along, and my dad's temporary job became his real one. I shook my head. Anyway, she left us and went to New York to make it, and then to London, because there's no acting jobs in L.A. And then, once she was gone, Jillian didn't really make time for me when I was growing up. I didn't see her very much occasionally, but, Darcy, I'm so sorry. I could practically feel Russell's eyes searching for mine. But to get through this, I needed to be looking at the asphalt or the tangly fur on Andy's back, not his blue-green eyes. Well, I feel like it almost would have been better if she had made it. If she had become a movie star like she always wanted, like it at least would have been for something. But she just married a British guy and had three kids with him, kids she actually takes care of. I heard Russell draw in a sharp breath. Tears were starting to prickle my eyes, and I held the dog a little closer. A part of me still couldn't believe that I was doing this, sharing things I had never told people, things I never even usually let myself think. But I was fine with how things were, I said, shifting Andy to one arm and brushing my hand across my eyes quickly. I mean, I adjusted the dog again. He was starting to get heavy. Russell reached out and took him from me, carefully, his eyes not leaving mine. He settled Andy in the crook of his arm. The dog blinked, unfazed, and yawned again, and gestured for me to keep going. I looked up for just a moment at a cloud crossing the moon and took a breath. What was the point in lying? If I'd ever had a moment where I could be totally honest, it would seem to be now. Okay, maybe I wasn't fine. I was pretty angry with her. I am, I corrected the second later, but I'd really come to terms with it. I was okay with the status quo we'd found, you know? But then something happened? Yeah, when she and Anthony, that's her husband. Why does everything sound better with a British accent? It really does, doesn't it? Sorry, go on. Well, when they moved from the UK to Connecticut, Jillian got a job in human resources at Stanwyck College, and suddenly she's back in touch, insisting I apply to Stanwyck, making sure that I know that employees' kids get basically all their tuition paid. Right? And I didn't think I'd need it. I heard the frustration explode in my voice as this came out louder than I expected it to. I applied to a whole bunch of other places, schools that I actually wanted to go to. And I kind of wish I would have looked at Stanwyck before all this, so I would at least know how I felt about it. Well, I get that. And then, Brisket, Russell filled in, and I smiled. Brisket, I agreed. So when I only got into two schools, it felt like it wasn't even really a choice. A free ride or loans my whole life. I turned to face him more fully. Oh, sorry, loans are what you take out to pay for school when your father isn't a rock star. Hey now. And it just feels like I'm trapped. But then I feel so guilty because I'm getting my college paid for. And who cares how it's happening, you know? I should be grateful. Wow, this is sounding familiar, Russell said, giving me a smile. The kind that actually makes you look sadder over Andy's head. So tomorrow I start there, just like she wanted. And me going there is like saying I forgive her, you know? That what she did is somehow okay. It's like she's bought me off knowing I couldn't turn it down. And I let out a long, shaky breath. This was the problem with the whole situation. Nothing was going to change. I could feel whatever I felt, but the reality was I was getting on a plane tomorrow and this was happening.
She even offered to pick me up from the airport, like she can just snap her fingers and pretend she's my mom. Back when I'd first told her I'd gotten in, Jillian had sent me a series of excited emails asking me for my flight information, saying she would come and get me, help show me around campus. I hadn't responded to any of them, and each subsequent email had fewer exclamation points until they stopped coming altogether. "Wow, that's a lot," Russell said quietly, echoing what I'd said to him. "And the worst part is, I'm dreading going to college. And that's not how it should be. I should be excited. I should be thrilled to be off on this whole new adventure. And instead, I just want to pretend it's not happening and take a nap." I could see down in the street ahead of us Wiley Sanders Gates. We'd almost made it back, like I'm sure you would have gotten off the wait list even without your dad. But I'll never know for sure. And I might have really liked Stanwyck if I'd just come across it on my own. But now, yeah, Russell agreed. I know what you mean. It's hard. Yeah. We walked together, Wiley Sanders' house getting ever closer. And I realized I felt a bit lighter. Not that anything had changed. I had just, in fact, been made aware of how intractable the problem actually was. But it did feel better to have shared it, that there wasn't some burden I was both hauling around with me and trying to keep hidden. "Thanks for telling me," Russell said, as we approached Wiley's gates. I nodded. "And you too, for telling me, I mean." And unfortunately, this is where I might have to stop today because we are out of time. I hope that everyone enjoyed today's program as much as I did. I want to say hi to all the listeners out there, and I want to encourage everyone to tune in next week when I continue with the fascinating novel titled The Ballad of Darcy and Russell. Until then, I hope everyone has a great day and a fantastic week. So long and take care, everyone. Goodbye.